Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome. Welcome. Well, we are a little late starting today. We've been trying to find Gail Sheehy. She's missing in action. but we are very fortunate that we managed to get hold of our second guest today. And we're going to bring her on in just a moment. We've actually talked with Nicolette Hahn-Niemann before. She is an awesome writer. And, you know, for decades, environmentalists have argued that livestock, sheep, pigs, cattle, especially cattle, are public enemy number one when it comes to soil erosion, air and water pollution, and damage to lands, damage to the wildlife population even. But it's not that simple, argues my guest, and if you wrestle between enjoying meat and being vegetarian for health and environmental issues, you'll definitely want to hear what Nicolette has to say. She was Bobby Kennedy's senior environmental lawyer, now turned vegetarian cattle rancher. And she's written a new book called Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. And if her name's familiar, it's because she has been on our show before with her other book, Righteous Pork Chop, which actually is one of our most listened to podcasts in the archive section. So we're going to take a quick break so I can just quickly connect with Nicolette, and we will be right back with you talking about Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
They seem like such a perfect couple. There must be some other explanation.
Why doesn't she just leave?
I don't understand why she puts up with him.
It takes two to argue.
It's not my place to interfere.
If someone you know is a victim of intimate partner abuse, you can give them back their voice.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, writer and activist Frank Schaefer, former evangelical and author of Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. See conversationslive.net for more than 300 conversations with experts ranging from conservationists to National Geographic explorers, New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, and cutting-edge health and well-being professionals. And join us live every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And Nicolette Hahn-Niemann is my first guest. She's the author of Defending Beef. She previously served as senior attorney for the Waterkeeper Alliance, running the campaign to reform the concentrated production of livestock and poultry. In recent years, she's gained a national reputation as an advocate for sustainable food production and improved farm animal welfare. She's the author of Righteous Pork Chop, which we talked about on our show a few years ago now. But she's written also for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Huffington Post, and The Atlantic Online. And she lives on a ranch right now in Bolinas, California, with her husband, Bill Nyman, and their two sons. Nicolette Han Nyman, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Very pleased to have you here. Righteous Pork Chop, as I said at the top of the hour, was it's one of our top podcasts for listening people listening in the archives.
Really nice to hear. Thank
you. A lot of interest around it. And, of course, Righteous Pork Chop was the subtitle was Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farming. It was part memoir and part expose. I want to just, for people who didn't hear that and aren't familiar with your work, and you're doing great work, and much of it, I know, very active in this environment. But last time we talked, you said that when Bobby Kennedy Jr. asked you, as an environmental lawyer, to spearhead his campaign against meat industry pollution in 2000, you just were not thrilled about it. And I remember you saying, you know, boy, I'm a vegetarian. This issue has nothing to do with me. What am I doing? So just fill us in a little on how you got started in this line.
Yeah, well, I had been a biology major in college. I always had a lot of interest in the environment and science and nature. And I went on to become a lawyer and kind of had the idea in my mind that I would always get involved in environmental law. But I started working, you know, as a prosecuting attorney and worked for a law firm. And then I actually saw a speech by Bobby Kennedy Jr. about the work that he did as an environmental lawyer. And it really inspired me to return to that idea. And I began working for National Wildlife Federation. And then I was actually offered a job by Bobby Kennedy Jr. to go work for him in New York. And my work had all been in water quality work, protecting water resources and, you know, fighting against polluting industry and that sort of thing. And also air quality was another issue I worked on. And when I came to the job in New York, I didn't know very much about the livestock industry or the impact that it has on the environment. I just had kind of vague ideas about it. But he asked me to work on it full time, and I kind of thought, you know, oh God, that's not really what I want to do, because I knew it meant working full time on manure, which just didn't seem very glamorous. And I also, as you mentioned, I was a vegetarian. I'd been a vegetarian for a long time. So I kind of thought, well, that's not really connected to my daily life.
Right.
And, you know, of course, that was all wrong. I mean, I was totally wrong about all that. But that was my initial feeling. And then I began to learn more about the issue, because Bobby is a very smart guy, and he told me, listen, just go and visit some of these communities where there are these big hog and poultry operations, and you'll see what I'm talking about, and you're going to want to work on this. And that was absolutely true, because when I visited these communities in Missouri and North Carolina initially, and then later I went all over the country, but I saw tremendous pollution that was happening from these really large, concentrated, industrialized facilities. I saw enormous, sort of community impacts. I met a lot of people that were directly affected by the odor and the water pollution. I met people whose well water was contaminated. They could no longer drink their own water. I mean, the impacts were amazing and really, really troubling. And what was most troubling was that there was nobody that was helping these people. The government was not being helpful in the least. And so it became my full-time job working for Waterkeeper Alliance to work on livestock-related pollution.
Right.
But at the same time, as I was doing that, I was also visiting farms and ranches that were doing things very, very well. And so I began to see there was a dramatic difference, you know, that if you just sort of condemned all livestock production, you were kind of, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because there's really an opportunity for the most ecologically sustainable form of food production when you have animals as part of the farming operation. So I kind of began seeing that it was not such a simple issue. It was not that, you know,
it's not black and white.
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, it's portrayed a lot of times in the media. I just saw another one, you know, this basically meat is, you know, the environmental scourge of the planet kind of article. I see them, you know, people send them to me, so I get them. I get several a week in
right,
my inbox.
Right.
And it just really oversimplifies the issue, because I've now been working on this issue for 12 years, And through the work I started with Bobby Kennedy, I actually met my husband, Bill Nyman. You mentioned it in the introduction.
Right.
He's the founder of a network of sort of traditional grass-based, smaller-scale farmers and ranchers around the country who use really ecologically sound farming methods. And then I moved, after we got married, I moved from New York City to California, and so I've been living on a ranch and working on a ranch for the last 12 years. So I've really seen firsthand the importance, actually, of having cattle on the land and maintaining the grass ecosystem with cattle. But then at the same time, I wrote my book, Righteous Pork Chop, and I've continued to do a lot of research about the harmful effects of badly done livestock production. So it's very different depending on how you do it. And the environmental impacts and the community impacts, everything is wildly different depending on whether you're doing things well or badly.
Right. Well, Publishers Weekly called you, let's see what they called you, a force of nature when it comes to debunking the untruths about raising beef, the beef effects of global warming and the connection between eating beef and heart disease, and that eating beef is the reason Americans are fatter than ever. I mean, you bust the fact from fiction. And I want to look at some of those issues, Nicolette. Because you do balance, as you said, you do take an all-round look at this and look at both sides of the fence. So, first of all, you are not saying we should eat more meat. You're just saying we need to eat meat differently. And I have to tell you, because I was a vegetarian for 8 years, and I think it was right around the time that we first talked, I started introducing meat back into my diet because I wasn't feeling great. Too many grains did not suit me, and I started having... You know, I was gaining weight. And so I started eating meat again. But lately, it has just not tasted good. And so I'd gone back to almost being vegetarian. And then I was like, you know, I need to find a butcher that has really great grass-fed meat. And the difference is night and day in the taste, for one. But so let's talk about what you're talking about when you're saying you're not telling them to eat more, just eat differently.
No, and you know, the story you just related is really interesting because I just posted something on my Facebook page the other day about 84% of people, according to research, who are vegetarians for a time, then eventually go back to meat eating. And I've found in my own personal conversations with people over the last few decades about this, because I've been a vegetarian for almost 30 years, I have found that most people tell me sort of what you were saying, they didn't feel right health-wise. There was some issue with either their energy level or they weren't sleeping well. I talked to a woman who had a real dental problem apparently was related to her diet. And so, there are lots of reasons why people make changes in their diet. I'm not telling people that they should eat meat. But what I do, my book is about half ecological argument and discussion and about half nutrition and health. And what I try to do is really pick through, sort facts from fiction about these issues so that people can make wise choices. And what I really became, convinced of when I was really delving very deeply into the health and nutrition issues surrounding beef specifically is that we've been told for a very long time, several decades in the United States, it's been the kind of the message that beef is an unhealthful food, primarily because of the saturated fat content. Now, when you just have a piece of fresh beef, as opposed to like processed meats, which usually add a lot of fat to it, but if you just eat a piece of steak or something, it's actually not all that high in saturated fat. But what I go through in my book is I go through a kind of a long discussion about the history of the thinking about saturated fats, and it's really dramatically changed.
Didn't it stem from a report in like the 50s?
Yeah, well, there was a study that was called the Seven Countries Study that was done by Ansel Keys, who was an epidemiologist and physician from Minnesota who had the idea that saturated fat caused heart disease and other chronic diseases. And it was good, he had a fairly solid basis for that idea at the time. And then this idea was followed up by some additional research and some clinical studies that seemed to support the idea. But we kind of have gotten past those studies now and that thinking. There's a lot of more recent clinical research and epidemiological research as well that really that shows that the link is not strictly with meat or red meat, that it's probably more likely to be associated with the processed aspect of the food. And so, like, there was a big study that was done by Harvard School of Public Health, and there's been some big studies done in Europe that showed that when you strictly looked at the health effects of fresh meat, that there were really no tangible negative health effects from that. And if you just clumped all meat together, because people do eat processed meat, right. You know, whether you're talking about bacon or ham or salami or whatever, there is some connection with processed meat and health problems. And it's still not clear why. Nobody really knows what the health issue is.
I think it might have something to do with those 30-plus additives they put in.
Well, that's the thing. That no one has really teased those issues out.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, there are additional ingredients that are put in there, and, you know, whether it's the smoke, you know, artificial smoke flavor, or whether it's the salt or nitrates, really nobody's really sure what it is. But it's very clear that when you strictly look at fresh meat, the health effects, the links are not there. And what I also discovered, I really didn't fully appreciate, because I haven't been eating beef myself for so long. I hadn't really thought about the nutritional content of beef that much until I did the research for this book. And I found that there's not just a lot of nourishment in beef, but it's uniquely usable by the body. So the type of iron, the type of zinc, the type of protein that are contained in beef are your body can assimilate them very well, and much better than just strictly plant-based nutrients, especially. So I don't argue that people should eat beef, but my point is that for people who choose to do so, it's a good choice. It's right. A good dietary choice. And, in the first half of the book, I argue that if you choose from good sources, it's a good ecological choice as well.
Right, right. So let's look at the environment, because one of the things we've heard for many years, and, I used to live down in San Diego and was doing a course up in Riverside, east of L.A., and they have a lot of cattle farms out there, and there's no grass.
Yeah.
There's no grass there. It's just dirt and smog. And so I kind of bought into that, the methane myth, as you say, because we're told that the cattle are causing all this methane, which is adding to the greenhouse gases, which is increasing global warming. You say, wait a minute, it isn't that simple. So talk to us a little about that, Nicolette.
Right. Right. So there, of course, there's an element of truth to it. You know, every good public myth has an element of truth, and that's why it gets, fostered. Absolutely, it's true that cattle cause some methane emissions. What is not true is how this has been so dramatically exaggerated as far as its total importance. In the United States, the official government figures, the Environmental Protection Agency of the federal government, says that all of agriculture causes 8% of global warming gases. Now, the cattle of the food industry, the beef and the dairy cattle, are just a small portion of that. So the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Environmental Protection Agency have quantified that amount, that total contribution from the cattle, all the cattle in the United States, at about 2% of global warming gases. Now, 2% is not something we should ignore. I think that also is important. But it often gets stated, and in fact, there's a movie out right now that's saying this over and over again, that more than half of global warming gases come from cattle. That is simply wildly untrue.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most important thing to start the conversation with, to just understand that the contribution is about 2% of all global warming gases from cattle. Now, what can we do to mitigate that 2%? So there's a lot of research all around the world being done on this issue. And, I note in my book that the single largest human generator of methane in the 1980s was actually rice farming. And that became known. And so rice farming was really carefully looked at and was altered. You know, there were a lot of things done to improve the methods of rice farming, and the methane level was brought down. It's still, actually, rice is still a major contributor of methane to the world. But
you know, I've never heard that before. I've never heard that rice is a major contributor to...
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
So it's funny because I've never met a vegan that advocates for getting rid of rice. To me, it's kind of an example of, you know, how the idea, you can't just look at cattle and say, well, they cause methane, therefore we need to get rid of beef. I mean, it's not logical. There are lots of things that cause various different pollutants. We don't say we're going to get rid of cars. I mean, fossil fuels are by far, they're about 90% of the global warming gases in the United States are from fossil fuels. But no one is saying we should get rid of cars or airplanes, right? So it's not rational or reasonable to say that we need to get rid of cattle simply because they cost nothing. But there's also a lot of really good research around the world that's being done, just like it was for rice farming, to reduce the methane. And one of the things that's been found is if you have better land management, if you have better grazing practices, mm-hmm. the methane comes down pretty substantially. And there are other really interesting things that are being tried. There's research in Australia that shows if you just have certain things added to their salt licks, that you can reduce the methane substantially that way. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff being done out in the field all over the world to try to reduce the methane from cattle. It's going to happen. And to me, we sort of have to wait until that research is fully complete and ready to be applied on a grand scale. But we know these things are in the pipeline. And in the meantime, one of the things I argue in my book is that actually the total amount of carbon sequestration that can be fostered from cattle grazing may be larger than the total amount of all greenhouse impact of the cattle in the food industry. So we really need to be focusing on how we reduce global warming impacts, not just trying to, halt the rise of global warming emissions. And the only way to do that people have really come up with on a grand scale, is to sequester carbon back into the soil.
Which is
difficult,
right?
And there's a lot of good work on that being done around the country showing, and the world showing, that you can actually sequester a lot of carbon in the soils with grazing animals.
Yeah, I remember reading in your book that they just left that out of the study because they thought it was too difficult to do.
Exactly. It's hard to quantify the amount. And so, like, the most recent United Nations study that talked about, that really focused on agriculture's contribution to global warming, stated that this was a very substantial number, but how much carbon could be sequestered back into the grasslands on where grazing animals are. But it did not attempt to quantify it because they said, the science is kind of nascent on this, and so we can't really quantify it yet, so we're just not going to put it into the calculation. Now, that's a really debatable thing for them to have done, because there are a number of credible scientific bodies that suggest that number may be so big that it might even offset all of agriculture's global warming impacts. So we know it's a big number how much carbon sequestration can occur from grazing animals. We just don't know how much.
Right.
But to me, that's further proof of the idea that it's a very short-sighted solution to get rid of grazing animals. If you want ecosystems to function properly, and if you want carbon sequestration to work in those grasslands, you have to have the grazing animals.
Right. Well, you write in the book, Cornell University Professor of Agriculture and Ecology, David Pimentel. Is it Pimentel?
Pimentel, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he said that, and he's known as a fierce critic of the food industry, especially the meat sector, yet he emphasizes that the role of cattle and other grass-grazing animals is irreplaceable in terms of human survival.
Yeah, it's very interesting because Pimentel is a controversial but respected food ecologist at Cornell University. And what's interesting about his work and his writings is he's often cited by vegetarian and vegan advocates who say, he talks about all these negative, ramifications of livestock. But Pimentel is not an advocate of getting rid of livestock at all. You know, he's kind of, he and I are in a very similar vein. He's a critic of a lot of the modern industrial practices that are wasteful and polluting. But he actually repeatedly argues that there are many attributes that livestock can add to a food system that nothing else can add. And he writes about those a lot in his various writings that he does. And one of the things he says is that basically, especially in the developing world, where you have a lot of people who are living, you know, on very slim margins. I mean, they're nearly into starvation mode. But having the livestock makes their survival possible because there's a flexibility with livestock. You can keep the livestock alive. You can milk them. You can slaughter them when you need to, according to what's happening with the resources that you have available. Crops are very different. You know, you plant a seed, it grows, you have to harvest it when it's mature. There's no choice. There's no flexibility there. And with a lot of crops, they're highly perishable. So you have to harvest them. You have to sell them right away. Livestock is really different. And as I talk about in some depth in my book, the majority of the world's livestock are actually being raised on lands where you can't even grow crops. So it's really an enhancement, a very important enhancement to our food system to have the grazing animals.
Right. Well, okay. Let's talk about water, because that's the other big argument that I hear against cattle. And you actually write in the book that it's often said that the future wars will be over water, not oil. And talk to us a little bit about that, because that's, you know, that's not as we think. Again,
yeah, it's interesting. That issue has I've been asked a lot about the water issue since my book came out, because right now in California, we're actually experiencing one of the worst droughts in over 100 years here. We just had some great rains, which is wonderful. But you know, over the long term, we're still in a major drought right now. And so there's a lot of concern about cattle and water and how, you know, is it even sensible, let's say, to have cattle in a state where we're experiencing a serious drought right now. And in the book, I go through this in a lot of detail. My, you know, this is really my specialty because I was a water attorney for 3 years. That was my main focus. And one of the things I point out is that when you look at worst-case scenarios as far as water consumption of raising cattle, the numbers look really bad. But when you look at a typical figure for raising a pound of beef, producing a pound of beef, or especially when you look at a figure for producing a pound of totally grass-based beef, the water figure is not very high, actually. It's not an outlier compared to a lot of other foods. So mentioning rice again, I mean, not to be like hammering on poor rice here, but just to use it as a basis to compare the rice is just slightly more water intensive. If you compare a pound of beef and a pound of rice, it's about the same. And humans consume a lot of water intensive foods. They include coffee, chocolate, sugar, avocados, walnuts, almonds. There are many foods that are water intensive, and beef is not really different from those. So I think that's an important point for people to understand. And when we plan food systems, we need to think about these issues. But again, it's not a reason to banish beef from our landscape, or cattle from our landscape, or beef from our table. And the other aspect about beef is really well-managed cattle, and this is what I'm really advocating for in my book, that we need to improve the management of the grazing of almost all cattle all over the world. There are some areas where it's being done very, very well, but there are a lot of areas where it's being done not nearly well enough. And if you manage cattle well, you actually create highly functioning ecosystems that have more plant diversity, more animal diversity, and here's the important part to go back to the topic you asked about, which is water. It actually creates soil that holds more water than any other land use that you can use it for in agriculture. And the longer water is held in the soil, the better it is for all of the life that's in that location. So it's better for all of the soil life, it's better for all of the plants that come out of the soil, all the vegetation, and it's better for all of the animals in that ecosystem. So the ecologist I cite in my book, Alan Savory, calls that effective rain. When you have rain that stays in the ecosystem. That rain is effective. It has a lot of beneficial effects. And well-managed grazing actually produces optimal situations as far as how much water is maintained in the ecosystem. So that's the kind of big picture thinking we need to be doing when we're talking about these questions.
Right. And I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's big picture thinking, not just looking at one little study that's taken out of context. We need to look at the whole big picture here. And you've got 20 pages of notes at the back of your book. This is a really well-researched book. How long did it take you to put this together, Nicolette?
Well, I had the idea, actually, when I was writing researching and writing for Righteous Pork Chef, I started thinking about this because I thought, you know, it's ironic that there's more criticism about beef, and as myself being a vegetarian, I gave up beef first, you know, because I thought it was the worst.
Right.
And I was doing the research for Righteous Pork Chef, and I was talking about each sector of the meat and dairy and egg industry individually, and I thought, my God, beef is really the best, and it gets the most negative press. And so I sort of had this idea in the back of my mind, like at some point I'm going to write about this, you know, about that dichotomy, sort of the difference between the rhetoric and the reality. And then I started saving, you know, books and saving articles. And it took me a little bit over a year to actually write the book from when I began and sat down, but I'd been gathering materials for about 5 years.
Well, I thank you for being with us today. You know, as I said, Righteous Pork Chop is one of our most listened to podcasts. Listeners can find that on the show, conversationslive.net, and just type in Nicolette Hahn Nyman, H-A-H-N, and Nyman is N-I-M-A-N, and it will pop straight up. And this book is called Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher. Gotta love that. Gotta love it. Because you've got all perspectives there, Nicolette. And final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Well, I just want to encourage people that this issue is a lot more complex. It's something people think they know. You know, they think that they know that beef are bad for the environment. They think that they know that beef is bad for our health. You know, I ask people, open up your mind and consider that that might not be the case.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for being with us again. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And you can find more about Nicolette. Remind us of your website, Nicolette. Is it your name?
I have a Defending Beef Facebook page, and I also have a website with just my name, NicoletteHahnNyman.com, and I've got links to a lot of my writing there.
Awesome. Thanks so much. We will take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by my next guest, Gail Sheehy. Please do stay tuned. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services, if you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki@VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, writer and activist Frank Schaefer, former evangelical and author of Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. See conversationslive.net for more than 300 conversations with experts ranging from conservationists to National Geographic explorers, New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, and cutting-edge health and well-being professionals. And join us live every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Notice anything different? You should. There's no other station like Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my next guest was known in the 60s as the girl journalist. She broke through cultural taboos of her time to build a daring life and career, and that's what we're discussing today. Her newly released memoir, Daring, My Passages, which is really a testament to guts, resilience, and smarts. So let me tell you who my guest is. Gail Sheehy, the author of 16 books, including the classic New York Times bestseller Passages, which was named one of the 10 most influential books of our time by the Library of Congress. She's a multiple award-winning literary journalist and one of the original contributors to New York Magazine, and has been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair since 1984. Gail Sheehy, welcome to the show today.
Hello. You won't believe this, but I'm running up the street to try to catch my car service in front of Bloomingdale's. It's a mad Christmas rush in New York.
So I'm just curious, after you had such a great hit with Passages and you've spent this terrific career, you spent the next four decades of your life, you say, interviewing thousands of women and men, from high schoolers in Harlem to Benazir Bhutto just days before her assassination. And suddenly you say you found yourself thrust into the passage of your 70s. Your husband was slowly dying, and you questioned, what did my life add up to? So you decided to turn the lens on your own passages. What made you want to put it down on paper and share it?
Well, I'm a writer, first of all, and anything important that happens in my life, but many of the important events in our social history, I write about them. That's how I sort of figure it out. And I thought examining my own passages with the lens that I've developed and honed over so many years could be illuminating and inspiring, because after all, I still made it to my 70s with a, having had it all by my 40s, having had to postpone some things and sacrifice some things, as everybody does, even though I thought I would have it all in my 20s, but the marriage blew up, as it often does. And so I thought it could be inspiring to other people, particularly people who are interested in the arts or a career for themselves, or who want to combine career with a loving family life.
Right.
That's the hardest that's the hardest job that women have, and they still do have a hard time.
They do, having to balance everything. So you were very persistent in your early days. There was this new kind of journalism coming about, and we've been experiencing a whole other new kind of journalism over the last few years with technology. But you really wanted to work with somebody called Eugenia Shepherd, and you just couldn't get in with her. And I was just... I just noticed how persistent you were, and eventually you get a call from her and she wants you to go work with her. What kept you going towards working with her?
Well, first of all, I've been campaigning to get an interview with her for about 9 months. I think that's how it all starts. I wanted to be a writer since I was in my, seven when I got my first typewriter, and I loved hearing the clack of the keys making words, and I thought I was really making a little book.
Right,
and
right.
When I was in married and putting my husband through medical school and stuck out in upstate New York, I kept reading the Herald Tribune, the great paper of its day, and reading the women's page, and that's the only place where girl journalists were able to get a job. So I kept writing to her. And then there was an awful long newspaper strike, and I didn't hear. Finally, I got a response. So I went in and had my, you know, my little pitch all prepared, and she hired me to be a feature writer. But I soon tired of, I didn't want to write about, you know, the latest fashions for young matrons giving tea parties. I really wanted to write about the things that Tom Wolfe was writing about, the, you know, the radical chic and the things that Jimmy Breslin was writing about, kind of the theater life and low life of New York. So I had to sneak out of her office and down the back stairs to the city room, the testosterone zone where only men worked, and pitched my best story to Clay Felker, who later became the man who shaped my career and much, much later became my husband.
Right. I mean, I know he had a lot of influence on your career, but tell me specifically how he helped you shape your career and become a literary journalist, how you broke out of writing those fluff pieces, if you will, because that's really all women did write about back then were the fluff pieces. This is too funny.
I know, we're in the middle of the Christmas shopping rush in New York, so you're hearing
beep, beep.
And noises. Well, Clay gave me the best advice that I had very early in my career. He asked me, after I'd only written a few stories for him, what I knew about politics. And I said, well, my father is a country club Republican, and my mother is a natural-born bomb-throwing Irish bomb thrower. So what I know about politics is it's about fighting at the dinner table. And he said, great, then you'll understand Bobby. I said, Bobby who? Bobby Kennedy. He's running against Jean McCarthy for president, and I want you to cover his campaign. And I said, me? I've never written a political story. And he looked at me and said, Gail, the way to make your name as a journalist is not to do a lot of little stories. No matter how good they are, they're not going to change the conversation. What you have to do is tackle a big story, something everybody's talking about, but they don't know the why. And so I did. I took the dare, went on the campaign, had a fantastic time, was able to sit next to Bobby Kennedy on a yo-yo flight up and down the Cascade Mountains of Oregon, and finally got an interview. And then just as we were trying to land in Portland, we couldn't see, but the plane was heading straight towards our plane. And all of a sudden, in the mid-drop, Bobby Kennedy put, I knew Jean McCarthy was desperate. I didn't know he was that desperate. And I could see from that humorous remark that this is a man who was a total fatalist. He had seen so much death in his family, mm-hmm. He was not afraid of it. In fact, he knew he was the target. And the next night, his own life was ended at the point of a gun. So it turned out that was a great dare to take, and I had a very, very significant story. And I learned to, you know, take whatever I, just go for the stories that I could find or that I was assigned, and kind of live in the middle of them.
Right, right. You had all this fabulous success. I mean, you were one of the first women, I believe, to be embedded in Warzone. You did a lot of daring stories along the way. You say that whenever you felt fear, you know, many people become paralyzed and just go into denial and don't do anything. But when you feel fear, you dare. Tell us what pushed you through that. Do you think that's just intrinsic to who you are?
Well, I'm a normally fearful person. We all have fear. In fact, it's at the base of all of our difficulties, because we either cover it over with anger or with pulling back and feeling weak or with being alienated. And I didn't like the feeling of pulling back from my fears. I had to find a way to let fear activate me. And so I began a habit. Actually, you know, whenever you might think it was reckless to put on hooker boots and blue suede hot pants and march up and down the street pretending to be a prostitute.
Now, you're not doing that now, are you?
No, not right now. I'm fully dressed, dancing at the door, and nobody would recognize me at all because I fell on my face and then I have a big bruise on one side. So I'm quite safe.
Right.
But I did a lot of things that people would think were either daring or even a little foolish. I followed Hillary Clinton into the ladies' room at a conference, and turned out she was feeling in despair because she was being blamed for the defeat of the Democrats in the by-election in 94 because of her health care policy. And she let her hair down and confessed to me she didn't know what to do anymore. And the next thing, she told me, thank you for writing The Silent Passage, because she was in menopause.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And that was one of the taboos that nobody talked about at that time.
Right, right. So, and you say it's very empowering to dare, and I do think that myself. If you're in fear, taking that action just seems to empower you and acts as a catalyst to spur you on. One of the things I was really struck by in the book, your first husband was a doctor. You put him through medical school. You worked while you were pregnant up until the very last minute while you were pregnant, and put him through medical school. And also your father, you say neither one of them acknowledged you as a writer, acknowledged the work that you did.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the end of your question. You were talking about me being pregnant and working until the night that I delivered.
Right, but neither your father nor your husband acknowledged you as a writer.
No, that's right. Neither of them read anything that I wrote, which was terribly disappointing. And not only that, my husband had an affair that he couldn't break. So that was one of the daring things I did. I had to dare to leave a marriage that I thought was, you know, the way I would be able to be a writer and support a family at the same time.
Right. Right. And back in those days, it was very different times. So, Gail Sheehy, pleasure talking with you. I hope you get done what you need to get done on the streets of New York today.
Thank you.
And have
a daring holiday.
I will. Thank you. You too. You too.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And my guest, of course, was Gail Sheehy. The book is called Daring, My Passages. And she was walking along the streets of New York there. So I do apologize for the sound. We couldn't get hold of her in the beginning. And we are almost at the end of our show now, right, Eric? We've got how many seconds left here? I just want to get something
Just a couple minutes. So.
Okay, we just have a couple of minutes here. All right, so I want to tell you, you know, this book is a good read. There's one of the things that you don't realize sometimes is how much progress we've made as women, because there's still women's issues, as they call them, out there. But when you go back and read, you know, from somebody in the 60s, what they were going through at that time to break ground, it's really interesting to see the differences that have happened. So, again, I apologize for that sound. What a crazy show that was, because we couldn't get hold of Gail in the beginning. And then Nicolette fortunately jumped in. And if you have, you know, if you bought into some of the myths that we talked about in the first segment with Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, which I did, I've been to environmental films, but you always have to look at the big picture. Who's funding this film? Who's funding this project? Who's funding this study? And look at the motives behind the funding, where the money's coming from, and get a big picture view of what's really happening. All right, we made it through. Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher by Nicolette Hahn-Nyman was the first book. And the second, Gail Sheehy's Daring, My Passages. She's in her 80s, by the way, now. So still active and still getting out there along the streets of New York. All right, we will be back next week. Actually, I'm on jury duty next week, so we have a recorded show for you next week. I've done a couple of interviews this past week, so you'll have brand new guests with no interruptions, hopefully, because it will be pre-recorded and edited. And you can get hold of me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, if you have questions or comments on today's show. You can also find me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also find us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And of course, we've got more than 300 podcasts on a huge range of subjects, at conversationslive.net. All right, we will call it a day, and we will see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong. If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
They seem like such a perfect couple. There must be some other explanation.
Why doesn't she just leave?
I don't understand why she puts up with him.
It takes two to argue.
It's not my place to interfere.
If someone you know is a victim of intimate partner abuse, you can give them back their voice.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to BioClean, the people that clean up the mess, we cover the world of animals. This week, December 14th, it's a remote healing Sunday with best practitioner Dr. Nels Rasmussen. We'll celebrate Hanukkah with the Jingle Cats and have open phone lines so you can call in for remote healing for you or your animal friends. Plan to call in early because due to sports, we'll have a shorter show. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, this week, 9 a.m. to 11:30, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, writer and activist Frank Schaefer, former evangelical and author of Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. See conversationslive.net for more than 300 conversations with experts ranging from conservationists to National Geographic explorers, New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, and cutting-edge health and well-being professionals. And join us live every Monday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.